It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning?
Yeah, he's on a trip today.
Trip, all right. Well,
out of town.
We still have plenty to cover. We will not reveal where the trip is to, since I don't know anyway.
He's on a magical mystery tour.
Yeah, there you go. So, elections.
Uh-huh.
And what's your take on what went down this week?
Oh, yeah, the Obama landslide. I want to point out, too, that the Obama landslide was an electoral vote landslide. It was not a popular vote landslide. And this election was another example of why the electoral system distorts the way that Americans actually vote. And it's going to provide some more fuel to folks to get rid of the electoral system, although many of the people who are critics of the electoral system are progressives, and it'll be interesting to see if they use this example much. I mean, they're quick to use the example of conservative candidates who win by an electoral landslide and not a huge popular vote, but I don't know if they will use this as an example. It'll be interesting to see. I think a lot of people, I think the real news of this election were the long lines at the polls and the huge voter turnout, the number of people who had never voted before, who registered, went to the polls, even voted early in a lot of states, and ended up making this a historic election, not just in the fact that we were electing the first African-American president of the United States, but also because of just the extremely high voter turnout. It put a lot of stress on the system as a whole. There were, fortunately, in a lot of the districts where there were voting machines breaking down, the districts had printed up paper ballots, although you're always a little bit unsure in that case of whether or not the paper ballot's going to get counted when the results are done electronically. So I think there are going to be a lot of people, particularly on local levels in places where voting machines broke down. I think there are going to be a lot of people looking at that saying, don't we need a system where that's a lot more reliable, where we can have some kind of a verification of how people voted instead of just having them flip a switch and then crossing their fingers and hoping it's going to work.
And perhaps even a system that could accommodate all the citizens if they chose to vote.
Yeah, if and when they show up at the polls, instead of having people, you know, because I was pretty appalled hearing, even when I was listening to results from early voting in the weekend before the election, the Friday before, the Monday before, but also, you know, in that week before the election, people were going to the polls to vote early. We're standing in line for hours, 3, 4, 5 hours to get in and vote. And in a lot of cases, they had to provide food for those folks and water. And people would show up at the polls, and people who were disabled would have to cut to the front of the line because they literally could not wait in line for 3 or 4 hours to vote. So, you know, and it was that way on election day as well. It wasn't as if everybody showed up early and then nobody showed up on election day. No, the high voter turnout showed that if we have nearly a 100% turnout, it literally overwhelms the system. And so it asks the question, don't we need a national system, some kind of national standards rather than this state-by-state thing where there are no standards other than those specified by the state constitution or by state law for running elections and how to deal with voting and how many, whether or not you have vote by mail versus polls open, and when people can vote, et cetera. I think, you know, it might be time to talk about a national standard rather than state-by-state standards that vary.
All right.
So another interesting thing about this election, too, was the fact that Obama appeared to have very large coattails, is how it's often said. A lot of the Senate seats that were held by Republicans were lost to Democrats, including three or four really strong incumbents. Elizabeth Dole in North Carolina, John Sununu in New Hampshire lost his seat, Gordon Smith in Oregon, the first time an incumbent in the Senate has been voted out of office in Oregon in like the past 40 years. He lost to the Democrat in his race. And seats in Colorado, in New Mexico, and in Virginia were, you know, that were vacated by Republicans were also turned over to the Democrats in this election. So now you have a really strong Democratic majority in both the Senate and the House with a Democratic president. So it'll be interesting to see if that makes a real difference in the next 4 years. Here in here in Washington State, Chris Gregoire beat Dino Rossi with a much bigger margin than last time. And when you look at that, I think you might ask, you know, given that Dino Rossi literally stepped outside the bounds of the law to raise money to take on Chris Gregoire and was probably better funded this time around, and certainly ran far more television ads than he did last time. What's the deal? You know, did Gregoire capitalize well on the Obama popularity? Well, from my point of view, the Gregoire campaign ran probably one of the most inept campaigns I've ever seen, particularly in the early part of the race. When you turn on the TV and you see a Gregoire ad talking about stem cell research, you know that there's something wrong with the people who are running the campaign. I think the problem really is that Dino Rossi shot himself in the foot with all of the negative advertising. Right now, people have enough problems in their day-to-day lives with the economic fallout, with foreclosures looming, with job losses, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show, with job losses at a high, with rising food and gas prices and other pressures on family incomes, and incomes are not growing the way they should be to match inflation. People have enough negative stuff to deal with in their lives that when they turn on the TV, they want to get away from that. And being inundated with negative campaign ads is, I think, gonna be bad for you. Even if you might have a point to some of them, and I think people are getting much more critical too about campaign ads. They go, oh, that's just an ad. You know, I don't even really know if that's true. Or they might sit there and they might say, you know, it's an ad. It's not true. Ads are never true. You know, so I think people are a lot more sophisticated about that kind of stuff than we give them credit for. And I think right now, people were looking more for someone who could say positive things or say, I have experience, I know the way forward. And they weren't getting that from the Rossi campaign.
Yeah, I thought the Rossi campaign there at the end had some ads. I think they're all like pretty relatively negative, but there were some that were definitely much more polished than others. That just like, you know, put the hair up on the back of your neck because it was just so outrageous on some of the
claims
there.
They were
similar
making
to, you know, some of the early Gregoire ones. So
yeah,
where she cleaned up her act near the end, the Rossi campaign appeared to go the opposite direction.
Yeah, so that was certainly, I think he shot himself in the foot with some of that. There were some other good results in the state, too. Peter Goldmark edged out Doug Sutherland for lands commissioner. That'll be good news, especially for folks who have been flooded out with each successive rainy season in the last few years. And that's including this week when I just turned on the news last night and I saw flooding in eastern King County and Snohomish County. You know, those folks, they might be cheered to find out that there's somebody coming into office as public lands commissioner who's going to clamp down on some of the logging that causes a lot of the runoff and a lot of the flooding that hits our rivers downstream. Randy Dorn beat Terry Burgesson for superintendent of schools. That was basically a vote on the Wassel, actually a vote against the Wassel. In the really tight race between Darcy Berner and Dave Reichert, Darcy Berner ran a pretty tough campaign, but Dave Reichert, it appears, just barely inched her out to the tune of about 8,000 votes in that big sprawling district in East that covers a lot of Eastern King and Pierce counties. What was the biggest surprise to me personally was seeing that so many initiatives and ballot issues pass, including the regional transit Proposition 1 for extending Sound Transit. And it not only passed, it passed by a mile, literally by a mile. The city Proposition 1 for Pike Place Market, same thing, more than 60% of the vote in favor of that. The Parks Levy Proposition 2 for the city of Seattle, it passed by a mile as well, just, you know, more than 60% of the vote. State Initiative 1000, the physician-assisted suicide or death with dignity, depending on whether you supported it or not. It also passed with a huge margin. And the only thing that didn't pass, which I was happy to see, was the Tim Iman Initiative 985 that would have opened transit lanes to drivers. That was defeated, and defeated soundly. So I was pretty shocked. I mean, I opened the newspaper on Wednesday morning, and I'm like, what happened? This never happens that I get like 90% of what I want when it comes to an election. But I think people were really paying attention. You had an enormous turnout. And I think this is what happens when you get close to 100% turnout. You see a vote that reflects the values of the people in this region, instead of a vote that's mostly in response to whatever ads are being run on TV by business interests or by candidates with lots and lots and lots of money. So it was pretty encouraging in that respect. So overall, I think in this election, the lesson that I took away from it is that the Republicans lost soundly, not just because of the economy and not just because of the war in Iraq, not just because in bad economic times incumbents are usually swept out of office, but also I think because, as I said before, people were looking for change. They were looking for somebody to say, I know the way forward, to say something positive in a time when there's enough bad news already. And I think there's a perception that the Republicans are do-nothings when it comes to the economy, and they needed somebody to say, I have a plan, this is what I'm going to do, and be specific about it. And that's something that Barack Obama did and that John McCain did not. And I have to say, in terms of the Republicans, that fear only takes you so far. That the McCain campaign seemed to be run on fear of this and fear of that. And that's what we had for 8 years of the Bush administration. And if McCain wanted to separate himself fully from the Bush administration, he should have said, that's fine, that's what they're doing, but this is what I'm doing, and to lay out a plan and say this is the way forward. And he never really did that successfully. So,
well, I don't know. Fear worked against him as well with choosing Sarah Palin, which, you know, a lot of people feared her.
A lot of people feared Sarah Palin,
potentially,
yeah.
President or
that's true.
Any position of power.
That's
all right,
true.
So
So, I mean, we can also look at this campaign, too, and say, and we can also look at these results and say, oh, you know, Obama is great, et cetera, and it was a historic election. But I just want to say to those people who were first-time voters, I hope you're not going to be too disappointed in Barack Obama. And I think we saw with his choice of his chief of staff this week, he chose Rahm Emanuel, that he's going to be right in the Democratic centrist mold. Rahm Emanuel is he's a former President Clinton aide. He is noted for playing hardball. That's what most of the analysts have been saying. Well, Rahm Emanuel plays hardball. He's a DC insider, et cetera, et cetera. And Obama needs somebody who's experienced to help him govern, et cetera. But what they're not saying really is that Emanuel is a Democratic centrist, which means he really sees the Democratic Party as the left wing of the Republican Party. He's a guy who helped President Clinton get NAFTA, push NAFTA through Congress. And NAFTA, just to remind people, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was originally opposed by progressive Democrats, by organized labor, by many social justice groups, and by a lot of people in who you would consider traditional liberals opposed NAFTA. Clinton pushed it hard, and Rahm Emanuel is the guy who really helped him get it shoved through Congress. And that's the direction that Obama will probably be going, is towards that Democratic centrist direction. In other words, towards the left wing of the Republican Party. And so I hope that folks who voted for him aren't too disappointed. I know that I voted for him just pretty much out of reflex to not get another Republican in office. And I didn't have too high hopes for him, and I'm trying to kind of tell people, don't have super high hopes for him, okay, so you're not too disappointed.
Can you name all the countries in NAFTA?
In NAFTA? Yes, in fact, I can. We found out this week that Sarah Palin couldn't name the three countries involved in the North American free trade agreement. She couldn't figure out that it was Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. We also found out that Sarah Palin thought that Africa was a country and not a continent. So I think it's kind of interesting that now the race is over, we're finally hearing from McCain insiders, little leaks on exactly how bad his vice presidential pick was, and that it totally confirms my initial feelings about her, that she would have been an absolute disaster.
So moving on to the economy, and I have to ask you, do you anticipate from all the election ad expenditures, which are an incredible portion of what is spent, that bubble, now that it's breaking, is going to affect us?
Yeah, that's going to affect the economy. Because, you know, these were the most expensive races, the most expensive presidential race, certainly in history, nearly $1 trillion spent. If we could take that money back, if we could get all that money back and apply it to the federal deficit, we could almost erase the federal deficit. That's how much money was spent on the presidential election. And, you know, now that the race is over, sure, it's going to have an impact on the economy. There are other numbers I want to run through here for you. This week, a report on manufacturing was released that showed manufacturing levels in the U.S. have dropped to the lowest level since 1982 and below the threshold that signals a recession. We talked a little bit about that last week, how we're obviously in a recession. Consumer bankruptcies this week, there were 106,266 filings in October. That's up 40% over last year and just up 20% versus last month. So just this past month, a huge surge in bankruptcies. So far this year, we've seen 880,000 bankruptcies, which is more than we saw in all of last year. And this is on top of the fact that it's now more difficult to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy than ever before because of the 2005 bankruptcy reform law that made it very difficult to file for Chapter 7 and get your debts forgiven. After the 2005 law was passed, bankruptcies dropped from 2 million in 2005 down to 600,000 in 2006. And, of course, they're even with the more restrictive law, they're creeping back up. That's a big sign of the ailing economy. Retailers reported this week that they had the weakest October sales in 39 years since 1969. The only store that appeared to have a gain was, guess who? Walmart. Yeah, 2.4% gain. But other budget stores like Costco saw a 1% decline. Target saw a 4.8% drop. Mall stores saw double-digit losses. And the biggest losses were among high-end retailers like Nordstrom, Saks Fifth Avenue, et cetera, who lost, you know, more than 15%, both of them. And that's really a sign that, yes, people don't have the money anymore to go out and splurge. And this is an interesting sign, too, when all retailers across the board see declines in October, which is heading into the Christmas season. That's kind of ominous for retailers as a whole, because this is the time of year when they make most of their money. The jobless rate this week, the official unemployment rate, I should say, the official jobless rate hit a 14-year high of 6.5%. This was higher than analysts expected. Analysts expected a gloomy report, and they expected about 200,000 job losses in October. But when the Labor Department issued its figures, it said, no, it's actually worse than that. It's 240,000 job losses. Even worse were the revised numbers for August and September. August, originally, the Labor Department said 73,000 job losses. It was actually 127,000. Big difference. September, which the Labor Department originally said was 159,000 job losses, it's actually 284,000. So a much worse September than anybody thought, and even worse than this past month. So far this year, the official figures are 1.2 million jobs lost. But I have to point out that the official figure doesn't count the cash economy. That's people who work for cash under the table. Many part-time jobs aren't in that number. Temp jobs often aren't all counted. People who work as independent contractors aren't included in there. The self-employed, et cetera. And for example, if you look at the official unemployment rate, which still doesn't count everybody, they say that the number of people out of work is 10.1 million, and that's a 2.8 million increase over last year. That's a 38% jump over the prior year. And if you look at that 2.8 million increase in the unemployed, but Maria, didn't you just say 1.2 million jobs were lost this year. Well, yeah, that shows you how inexact these numbers are when you count, when, you know, you're getting them from different sources and they're counting jobs in different ways. You can't really know. The point is, you can't really know the number of jobs lost. We just know the official figures are not the total number. It's higher than that, and it's worse than we think.
Isn't unemployed based on people who are getting unemployment insurance?
Yeah. Generally,
the, so once the official you're off that, unemployment. You fall off those numbers.
Yeah, you fall off that number, but that doesn't mean you have a job.
Right.
So it's much higher than that. It's much worse than we think. And Obama, in his first press conference after the election, he basically devoted it to talking about the economy. He said that it is now, his plan is now to pass an economic stimulus bill. He was basically speaking not just for himself, but also for the Democrats who now have a majority in Congress in both houses, that the next thing to do is to pass an economic stimulus bill, which will include infrastructure spending and an increase in unemployment benefits. The question is whether that will come in the lame duck session that Congress is going to have when they come back from vacation before the end of the year, or and whether they can get President Bush to actually sign that bill, or whether it's going to happen in January when Obama becomes president. He would also like to see it. He'd also like to impose a freeze in foreclosures, which I have to say is a must first step in stabilizing the housing market, and something that the Bush administration will not do. Obama also left open, here's the one thing that I picked out of his speech as important, he left open the possibility that he would change his tax plan. I know he ran on a middle-class tax cut, but he basically said, well, I because of the state of the economy and the state of the federal budget deficit, I may have to change that. Well, he's basically saying what I said a few weeks ago, which is that no matter who wins the presidential election, taxes are going to have to go up across the board in order to cover the federal deficit. And the deficit figure actually is going to approach $1 trillion this year, and in the next fiscal year may actually hit $2 trillion. So what is the Bush administration doing? Well, of course, they're AWOL, as you might expect, except they're pushing the Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson to speed up the spending of that $700 billion bailout package. They want to get as much of that spent before Obama takes office as they can, because they want to spend it their way. This week, the Treasury Department announced that they have scrapped a plan to buy troubled assets through a reverse auction. If you'll remember, this was what Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said he would do with the $700 billion, is that he would buy troubled assets. Well, now they're scrapping that plan altogether. And they may, he's left open the possibility that they may buy some troubled assets directly from some of these companies in a way that, you know, you have to ask, okay, you're going to buy them directly from these companies. How? How are you going to value them? How are you going to do this so that the government, the taxpayers get a good deal? The reverse auction was supposed to be a way to do that. It was a flawed way, but it was some way to guarantee that taxpayers would get a good deal in buying these assets. But when you say no, that's out the window, that means there are no controls anymore. So that's the Bush administration plan, is to continue to pour money into shareholders' hands and to the hands of executives at big banks. At the same time, it turned out this week that the reason that there hasn't been any initiative from the Bush administration to stabilize the housing market is because the White House is in an argument with the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, who long ago came up with a plan to help rescue homeowners, a plan that would have kept maybe 2 to 3 million people in their homes. This plan would entail the government, the U.S. government, taking about $50 to $60 billion out of the $700 billion bailout package and using it to negotiate with banks to cut the amount of loans that people, the amount of money that people owe on their houses, to cut it down to be closer to the actual value of the home. And the government would then cover half that loss, pay half of the loss that the bank would have to eat. They would pay half of that money to the bank and say, okay, this is to encourage you to negotiate with homeowners to cut their loans down to size and to keep these people in their homes. Well, the FDIC put forth this plan, and the White House turned it down. Dick Cheney and other hardliners in the White House, because I'm assuming George Bush simply doesn't understand the process. Dick Cheney and other hardliners in the White House said, no, we can't do that. That would be rewarding people for borrowing too much money. We would rather, instead, they would rather reward the big executives and shareholders at big banks and financial institutions. So that's a big reason why the housing market is still in such bad shape and why people are still being kicked out of their homes and nothing is coming out of the White House, is because they won't agree on a plan that the FDIC put forward and is ready to implement any day now. Literally, they could have started implementing it a couple of weeks ago, but the White House said no. So I think that's another big reason why people voted for Obama rather than for McCain, because of the perception that the Bush administration wasn't doing anything and the suspicion that they were actively clamping down on things that would have helped people who are losing their homes. And here is the proof. Yes, indeed, they are actively clamping down on the things that would help people stay in their homes.
All right. Well, just about a minute left. There is renewed fighting in the Congo.
Yeah, and you know, that's a part of the world that the Bush administration has pretty much completely ignored, is Africa. As Mike said, certain members of the Republican Party think Africa is a country, not a continent. The damage in the southern part of Africa, in the Congo, and among the nations that neighbor the Congo has been almost incalculable over the last 10 to 12 years. Nearly 5 million people have died from the fighting, from disease, and from famine. There's been renewed fighting in the last 2 months. At any time during the Bush administration, they could have sat down and said, look, there's a UN mandate to have peacekeepers in the Congo to prevent fighting and to stabilize the country. Why don't we put our troops there instead of invading Iraq? And the Bush administration didn't do that. They chose to focus on the war on terrorism. And as a result, renewed fighting in the last couple of months, nearly a quarter of a million people have been displaced. Tens of thousands of people are living in refugee camps who are not getting food, not getting clean water. Cholera has broken out. And the 17,000 UN troops who are there on the ground in the Congo are completely overwhelmed. It's an enormous country, and it's so easy for the rebels to outflank them. So there's hope that with Obama, our first African-American president, there may be some attention paid to the two biggest conflicts in the world today, in Darfur and in the Congo.
Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And tell us, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes around town, in the public libraries, and other places where you pick up free periodicals. We can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org.